Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, members of Congress are back after getting an earful from constituents during the spring recess. Members of the House and Senate held numerous town halls in their home districts, and healthcare seems to be one of the most prevalent topics. Many people across the country who are concerned about what they see happening in Washington, especially as it pertains to their health benefits.
And many people concerned about what will happen to their health coverage under the current administration. And while the American Health Care Act failed to come to a vote, the president is still expecting to see some definitive action on his vow to repeal and replace the health care law.
Republican leadership has also been working behind the scenes to retool the GOP legislation aimed at replacing Obamacare to be more amenable to the conservative Freedom Caucus as well as the more moderate Republican factions in order to reach the needed 216 votes to get the health bill on the House floor for a vote.
And analysts familiar with the new legislation say it's actually not that different from the first bill, Mark. It does eliminate the Medicaid expansion, removes many of the essential benefits that are currently required to be covered under the Affordable Care Act, and will create the high-risk pools that we kind of know by experience lead to much higher costs for certain sectors of the population.
Well, we'll keep an eye on the negotiations in Washington. Margaret, it's still important to look for trends that will improve the state of healthcare in this country. Our guest today, Dr. George Thiebaud, is CEO of the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, the only foundation dedicated solely to advancing the education of health professionals.
Dr. Thiebaud has had a long and distinguished career at Harvard Medical School, at Mass General, at Partners, and brings a breadth of clinical understanding as well as leadership experience to some very important trends underway on health professional training. So we really look forward to that conversation, Mark.
Lori Robertson also stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements made about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. Now, we'll get to our interview with Dr. George Thiebaud in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Health reform on the front burner again, Congress back from recess, and GOP leadership working behind the scenes, taking another crack at undoing Obamacare. The president indicating that Obamacare could soon run out of money, and he intimated that Democrats may want to think of negotiating with him on building that border wall between the U.S. and Mexico or risk losing health care funding. The president's spokesman, Sean Spicer, telling reporters they plan to get the House bill on health care worked out to the place where they can get the needed 216 votes so the bill can pass from the House to the Senate. GOP analysts say more moderate Republicans, swayed by recent visits back home where they faced many voters angered over the GOP plan to repeal the law, may not want to toe the party line when it comes to a vote or have it become an issue in their reelection. Folks in Iowa who self-insure or have gained coverage on the federal exchanges are going to be out of luck come the 2018 open enrollment period. All major insurers pulling out of the individual market in that state, as well as the exchange. Insurers saying they simply can't calculate assessment for 2018 rates without clear signals from Congress about what will be covered under the new law and whether the subsidies will continue to help underwrite the cost of insurance, potentially leaving many Iowans without any health insurance options. America has an unmet behavioral health needs problem. Of the 8 million Americans currently suffering from a diagnosable mental health condition, a significant number don't seek that attention. A recent study conducted by Langone NYU Medical Center looked at patient data from over 200,000 patients. Overall, about 3.4% of adults, representing more than 8.3 million people, reported serious psychological distress. By the end, 9.9% of adults with serious psychological distress say they couldn't afford to see a mental health care provider. Over that same time, the proportion of mentally ill adults who couldn't pay for drugs climbed from 8.7% to 9.9%. This, despite two U.S. laws designed to help those grappling with behavioral health issues, the 2008 Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act and the 2010 Affordable Care Act. In spite of those laws, access and affordability appear to have worsened for people with serious psychological distress. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. George Tebow, president of the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, the nation's only foundation dedicated solely to improving the education of health professionals. Prior to joining the foundation in 2008, Dr. Tebow was vice president of clinical affairs at Partners Healthcare System in Boston and director of the Academy at Harvard Medical School. He also served as the associate chief of medicine and the director of the internal medical residency program at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Tebow earned his undergraduate degree at Georgetown University and his medical degree from Harvard Medical School. He completed his internship and residency in medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Tebow, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, you've dedicated much of your career to advancing the discipline of medical education, as well as training the next generation of health professionals. The process of training healthcare professionals is really experiencing a dramatic shift. I wonder if you could share with our listeners what you see in the shifting landscape in medical education and how the foundation is working to advance these important shifts in thinking around the training of healthcare professionals.
Well, this is a time of dramatic change in the delivery system, and the education system needs to change to adapt to that, and I'm happy to say it is. I would say there's been more change in health professions education in the last decade than in the previous 4 or 5 decades. Some of those changes involve, importantly, preparing people to work in teams. Our education system has been set up historically educating our health professionals separately, almost intentionally keeping them apart, until they're fully trained, fully minted, if you were. And this is clearly not an advantageous way to prepare people for a career in which they're going to be working in teams. So one of the things the Macy Foundation has done over the last 9 years has been to promote interprofessional education, to make it a fundamental core competency of all health professionals that they not only understand what other health professionals have to offer, but how to work together in a team, whether as a team leader, as a team member, because all health professionals will be both at different times and in different settings. We also need to introduce new content into health professions education, which adds to the important base of the biological sciences, which remain the fundamental basis of understanding the pathophysiology of disease and the mechanisms of treating disease. We need to educate our health professionals not only in the science of teamwork, but understanding health systems, understanding health economics, understanding population health and the social determinants of health. So we've been working to add these content and integrate them carefully into the curriculum of health professions education, because we can't just keep adding one more course on the other. A third important change is to change the clinical model of health professions education. We have a model historically that's still based upon a rotational concept of giving health professionals, students, and trainees short exposures over a wide variety of settings and content areas. And while this has some advantage to it, a large part of the clinical education, we believe, should be done in a longitudinal way, so that the learner learns to develop relationships not only with patients, but with other health professionals and with the setting in which they're learning. So the learner can become a meaningful contributor. So these are three of the fundamental issues: interprofessional education, new content to complement the biological sciences, and longitudinal experiences to better prepare our health professionals to manage chronic disease, to manage patients in different settings, and to work as a meaningful member of a team over time to improve care.
Well, Dr. Tebow, you were originally founded with a core mission of advancing the science of healthcare and have progressed into these areas that make such a big difference in the quality of care we provide. I wonder if I could ask you to talk a little bit more with us about this fundamental shift in the approach to care delivery that team-based care represents, and maybe a little bit more about the kind of training and retraining that really needs to go on in health professions training, and particularly, I guess, in that early residency training in order to become effective members of teams. There's the interprofessional piece, but then team-based is something different. Tell us a little more about that, or maybe highlight some best practices that you've seen around the country.
So this is still work in progress. I don't think that we've yet arrived at the formula, and there may not be a final formula because every setting will have its own approach to it. All teams are different, as you know. There are teams that work together over long periods of time, and there are teams that come together only for a particular episode of care. And we need to prepare people to work in all those teams. A few principles that we've learned is that, first of all, there must be repeated exposures to teams and to interprofessional work. And then it has to be developmentally appropriate over time, from the early learner to the practitioner. We'll have different needs. So this process of continuous education has to be not only an education-long trajectory, but a career-long trajectory. Secondly, we do believe they have to be involved in meaningful work. The most lasting experiences are not just exercises to say that you've done it, but it really means showing that the whole really is greater than the sum of the parts by realizing that when you put together the experiences of a physician, a nurse, a pharmacist, a physical therapist, and a social worker, you actually come up with a better solution. Third is this has to be reinforced and supported by leadership. We have found that the most difficult part of this is moving into the clinical domain. I think we've done a very good job of getting this instilled into the kind of pre-licensure part of education for our health professionals. But getting into the clinical domain and the advanced clinical training has been the greatest challenge. But we have some wonderful examples. One of them is in the Veterans Administration, where the Centers of Excellence for Primary Care really have modeled interprofessional teams and interprofessional education with nurse practitioner residents and resident physicians.
You know, I note that we're seeing emerging trends from medical schools like Mayo Clinic, where they're shifting towards more online learning. And we just had the American Telemedicine President, Dr. Peter Yelilees, on the show talking about the need to dramatically shift the paradigm of health professional training in this direction. So could you talk about the emergence of this trend? What are you concerned about that might be lost in this transition?
Excellent question. The technology can certainly be, it can be an aid in interprofessional education, so that some of the interprofessional education can be done online using simulation and using asynchronous learning. And I do believe we need trainees to be at the various sites of care and not all concentrated in the academic medical center. Mm-hmm. Having said all that, I think we have to be very sensitive in how we blend these technological approaches with the real importance for face-to-face experiences, mm-hmm. not only with patients. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we'll ultimately find we're going to have to work out the right balance mm-hmm. of technology-based education and still the very human part to care for real people in mm-hmm. real time. Right now, the electronic medical record is getting a lot of negative feedback. It's being cited as a major reason for yeah. physician dissatisfaction and burnout, but doesn't mean we should throw the technology right. out. We just need to find out a better way to use it.
Well, Dr. Thibeault, under your leadership, the Macy Foundation has shown a real and sustained focus on the role of nurses as essential partners in practice and in leadership in healthcare. And the foundation has just released a report focusing on your study of the role of RNs in primary care. Can you talk a bit about your recent report, RNs, Partners in Transforming Care, and also how the recommendations that have emerged from that report will potentially help transform primary care and make a greater impact in the clinical setting as well as in leadership?
So the premise of this report, as you said, was that we've underutilized this incredibly valuable workforce. We actually believe more RNs could contribute meaningfully to both increasing the reach, that is, the number of patients that can be cared for, but even more importantly, increasing the quality of that care, which we have good evidence are not well done, like care coordination. To do this, though, is going to require some changes. And first and foremost are the nursing schools themselves. And it was widely acknowledged that nursing schools today are not teaching mm-hmm. The skills that RNs would need to be successful in primary care, because the focus remains predominantly on the acute care setting, is what they're preparing nurses for in their first post-graduation clinical encounters. And so a reform of the curriculum so that nursing students are exposed to excellent model primary care settings and that it's seen as one of the viable career pathways for RNs. But then, of course, there needs to be reform in the thinking about what's the proper makeup and structure of a highly functioning primary care practice. There are RNs, but they're there primarily to do a triaging function, which is not very professionally satisfying. But using them in their expert clinician role for care coordination, for preventive measures, for the care of complex patients under protocol basis clearly shows that it has value. And then we need to think about the career trajectory of nurses who choose a pathway in primary care. And right now, it's been pointed out to us, it's not clear that there is an upward trajectory, that they can continue to learn and that they can move up and be promoted. So we've gotten very positive responses. We've partnered with the American Academy of Nursing, and we've gotten very positive feedback around the country on this.
We're speaking today with Dr. George Thibault, president of the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, dedicated solely to improving the education of health professionals. Dr. Thibault was the vice president of clinical affairs at Partners Healthcare System in Boston and director of the Academy at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Thibault, since World War II, the Macy Foundation has focused significant research on the impact of war on mental health. And you said earlier, providers have a precious responsibility to care for real people. And some of those real people are in our military. And we've seen a tsunami of post-traumatic stress disorder cases in the wake of recent conflicts, which illustrate the need for more behavioral health clinicians to meet the demand. It and also shines a light on a far more prevalent scenario in American healthcare, the vast undermet burden of behavioral health needs. And I'm wondering how the foundation views the importance of training that next generation of health providers.
There's even a greater need to increase the awareness and skills of all health professionals in behavioral health issues and to more closely integrate behavioral health into the mainstream of healthcare, and reimbursement systems have driven things that way. The structure of the delivery systems have often driven things that way. And this is a time to bring it all together and not treat it separately, but it's seen as part of health and healthcare and part of the legitimate domain of any well-run delivery system and any fair and equitable reimbursement system.
Dr. Thibault, another area that we just are seeing a welcome and I think dramatic shift in how we think about health profession education is the focus that we're beginning to put on understanding the needs of patients that really arise out of what we call the social determinants of health. And, you know, I'd like to think in the community health center world, which is really founded upon addressing the social determinants of health, we've maybe had a leg up on this, but still one could say focused on population, focused on individual patients. But today we have this opportunity with tremendous data that we didn't have before, with the opportunity for a more systematic approach to really understanding for every patient and population of patients how the social determinants of health are going to impact their care and the management of their health conditions that we are engaged in. Can you just talk with us a little bit about this area of clinical training and education and how this is beginning to really be incorporated across the boards for health professionals?
Yes, thank you, Margaret. This is a very important area. So, you know, we know that if we look at what determines the health of either an individual or a population, that what we do in the delivery system probably at most is responsible for 20% of that. People can quibble about that number. Is it 15 or is it 25? But there's huge factors beyond the direct control of the delivery system, of the providing of health care that determines health. And we in the health professions, and particularly in health professions education, have paid too little attention to that, which is not to say that we can pretend that we can fix all those things, but we need to be preparing health professionals who understand those things. And then as professionals and as citizens can, when and where appropriate, participate in ameliorating them, but at least understand them in terms of knowing what are the factors that are going to influence whether their recommendations as a health professional are going to either be acted on or actually achieve the benefit that they hope they will. So we have been actively involved. It is part of this idea of expanding the content of what all health professionals should know. And in many ways, trying to influence the orientation of healthcare organizations, both schools and delivery systems, so they understand their role in this society-wide effort to improve health, and that they understand their sense of their social contract and social responsibility. We've been actively involved in supporting a what I would call a movement called the Beyond Flexner Alliance, which really was created to address this issue, to say that we need to build on the biological basis, the scientific basis of medicine, which is so important, but expand it to be a much more understanding of the social issues. Jack Geiger, the founder of the community mm-hmm. health movement, got the first Macy career
right.
lifetime award at the last meeting right. of this Beyond Flexner Alliance. So it brings us a full circle. With the
absolutely
community health movement that he so wonderfully helped to found. So this is an important issue. I think the community health centers are a shining example of having lived that. One of the things that we are supporting and encouraging is that more education go on in the community health centers so that more of our learners have that kind of experience that really does look at the patient in the context of their society, working directly with the community, and which also, in almost all instances, represents a good model of the team approach to care.
Well, we stand on Jack's shoulders, and we also appreciate your focusing on the role that community health centers can play. And we've been speaking today with Dr. George Thibault, president of the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, the nation's only foundation dedicated solely to improving the education of health professionals. You can learn more about their important work by going to macyfoundation.org, or you can follow them on Twitter at Macy Foundation. Dr. Thibault, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Health.
Thank you very
today.
Much. It's been my pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions made two dubious claims about marijuana and opioids. In an address to law enforcement, he said that marijuana is, quote, only slightly less awful than heroin, an illicit opioid. Experts say heroin is three times more harmful than marijuana based on a rating scale that takes into account lethal overdoses, dependence potential, economic harm, and other factors. No one has ever died of a marijuana overdose, but nearly 13,000 people died of a heroin overdose in the U.S. in 2015 alone. Heroin is also highly addictive, while only about 1 in 10 marijuana users become addicted, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Sessions also said he was, quote, astonished to hear people suggest that we can solve our heroin crisis by legalizing marijuana. While medical marijuana may not solve the epidemic, research suggests legalization may curb opioid overdoses, which have surged in recent years. According to the CDC, 52,404 people died of drug overdoses in 2015, 63.1% of which involved an opioid. This includes illicit opioids such as heroin and prescription opioids, including oxycodone and hydrocodone. Opioid-related deaths have gone from around 3 per 100,000 people in 2000 to over 10 per 100,000 people in 2015. Research published in JAMA Internal Medicine in October 2014 found that states with medical marijuana laws had an almost 25% lower annual rate of opioid overdose deaths on average between 1999 and 2010 than states without such laws. When the researchers included heroin overdose deaths, they got similar results, a 23% lower annual rate of deaths. Another study published in Drug and Alcohol Dependence in February 2017 found medical marijuana legalization was associated with a 23% reduction in hospitalizations for opioid-related dependence or abuse and a 13% reduction in hospitalizations for opioid-related overdoses between 1997 and 2014, again compared with states that hadn't legalized marijuana. The causal mechanisms to explain the relationship between opioid and marijuana use have yet to be fleshed out. But one study published in Health Affairs in July 2016 provided evidence that people may be swapping opioids for marijuana. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Chef Carl Guggenmos grew up as a kid in post-war Germany, he lived on a diet of organic and locally grown foods. Now he's the dean of the culinary arts program at Johnson & Wales University in Rhode Island, and he realized that he has a responsibility to teach the next generation of chefs how vital natural and simple ingredients are, not just to creating good food, but to the health of the population as well. He watched the obesity epidemic take hold in this country and decided to use his platform to create a new approach to chef training. He teamed up with a professor of medicine at Tulane University Medical School in New Orleans, and together they created what they believe is the first course in culinary medicine in the United States, teaching chefs and fourth-year medical students how to understand the synergy between healthy eating, good food, and good health.
Our graduates from Johnson & Wales or any cooking school really have to take responsibility for the health and wellness of the people that they serve food to. So we created this program where our students are actually going to Tulane Medical School for an internship, and they work side by side with medical students and physicians working in the community, doing research, using an evidence-based approach to this whole idea of culinary medicine rather than anecdotal.
So, in addition to learning knife skills, sauté and poaching techniques, fourth-year medical students are given a lesson in food pairings, learning which foods are most poised to foster good health and to combat obesity in their future patients' lives.
The medical students at the Center for Culinary Medicine, they have their own coursework that we help them develop, and they identify ingredients as to their relationship to health. They then start basic introduction to cooking, from knife skills to basically how to saute, how to poach, how to roast. And then they do recipe conversions, and then they have to do research. And our students are there helping, they're engaged, working, writing articles, being part of this whole program, working side by side with the medical students and learning and exchanging information and techniques from each other. The results and the responses are incredible. We're hoping to continue that. Dr. Harald and I have been out speaking about this as a joint, this collaboration between the chef and the physician. It's really unique and it's one of its kind, and I think it's the first around the world, and we're getting more and more traction about this.
He strongly believes in the idea that chefs will be the pharmacists of the future. A dean of a reputable culinary program teaming up with a medical school to train future doctors armed with the skills and information to assist their patients in healthier eating, fostering the development of health-conscious chefs who are trained to feed the next generation well with foods that can prevent obesity. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.